Thank you very much. Getting used to new rituals, turning off phones and plugging in microphones. It's a pleasure to be with you this evening. As most of you, I think a lot of our thoughts are on the elections tomorrow, and I was trying to think of some sort of connection between what I'm going to speak about this evening and the elections tomorrow. And the true answer as to what the two have in common is absolutely nothing. That's the true answer. But since it doesn't sound good, I tried, afal pi chen, still to come up with some sort of connection. That I will be speaking about a different type of leadership than that which we'll be electing tomorrow. We'll be electing our national leaders. But on a very serious level, the Jewish people is assigned an even greater role of leadership that is summarized by the two words, Mamlechet Kohanim. And by that term, translated as nation of priests, what we're really saying, or what the Torah is saying, is that we have a responsibility of religious leadership, not just to ourselves, because after all, we are all priests, all Jews, men, women, and children, from 13 anyways, 12 and 13. We are all supposed to be presenting religious leadership to the world as a whole. And it seems that even less in Israel than Chutz La'aretz, we really don't pay much attention to that, especially in our Orthodox circles. It's striking to me that in the recent years, in the last couple of decades, last 20 years, let's say, we've seen tremendous popularity by certain groups that have their roots in Orthodoxy, that have presented a taste of Judaism to those outside the fold and have enjoyed tremendous popularity. For example, Philip Berg's Kabbalah Center. I don't know if he has brought this to Ranana. It's a new, very showy center. It's just been put up in central Jerusalem. And it's interesting, the success to their venture in Israel is that he's been so successful with non-Jews teaching Judaism on some level. The Jews said there must be something to this Judaism that we also want to find out about it. But in fact, we know in the media, in Hollywood, many less famous people have been attracted by the study of Kabbalah, even on watered down and sometimes inauthentic level that is taught. But still, people are apparently thirsting for the message of the Jewish religion. Another person who's become quite famous in America, teaching Judaism to non-Jews, is Shmuley Boteach. I'm sure most of you have heard. Again, very someone who knows how to do PR. But you don't only sell by PR. You have to have something that you're actually selling. You need a product. And in fact, his product is Judaism. And Judaism is of interest to non-Jews. However, we more traditional Orthodox feel a tremendous reticence for many reasons of sharing what we have with non-Jews. And I'm only going to concentrate on one specific area this evening. And I understand that there are other areas and issues that need to be discussed. But given our time frame, this is a series of three different speakers about three different topics, will suffice to simply focus on this one issue. Did everyone have handouts? Anybody need a handout? Just maybe pass down, pass around to make sure. On that side, is everyone there? Okay. The source sheet is entitled, Will the Real Esav Please Stand Up? The idea being that one of the things that keeps us back in more harmonious, more interested relationship, religious relationship with our Gentile neighbors. And again, when we speak about Gentile neighbors, I'm speaking to you on a cultural level, not geographical level. All of us come from Western countries. And many of us still have interactions with non-Jews, either business or social, that we used to live next to, and some of us still fly to or write to. The world is certainly becoming a smaller place, but our central association with non-Jews is not really with the Arabs that live next door to us, but really with the Christian West where we came from. And even as a culture, I think Israel also, for better or worse, has much more to do culturally with the Christian West than it does with the Arab Middle East. Even with the Christian West, and even with the flourishing of relations that many of us have enjoyed, we often wonder whether it's really such a good thing. And when we think about our Jewish tradition, we don't believe, or most of us don't believe, the Jewish tradition has much positive to say about the Christian West. And that makes us reluctant and reticent to open up bridges and to share, with the sense that perhaps on the other side of the bridge, if we are to build bridges, there's a lack of sincerity, there is a root anti-Semitism, there is a viciousness. All of this, you know, the famous expression, if you scratch a goy, as the expression goes, you get an anti-Semite. This is what we've been grown up, what we've grown up with, but much of it is not just contemporary xenophobia or racism, but rather is something due to our tradition. This problem, on the one hand, of when we go to our non-Jewish neighbors, seeing often very upstanding, kind, honest people. I remember growing up in the United States, that having very close friends who were non-Jews, who were religious Christians, and I found very sincere, upstanding people. Yet, going back to my own tradition, I had to question that. Were my senses really telling me the correct thing? I call this the Chico Marx problem. My partner, Rabbi Cardoza, of course, quotes Kierkegaard and Schopenhauer. I quote Marx, not Karl Marx, Chico Marx. So Chico Marx says, when you have such a conflict, who are you going to believe? Me or your own eyes? We have a similar problem. We ask our tradition, who are we supposed to believe? Our tradition or our own eyes, our sensibilities, our reality? We see upstanding people, we go to the office, they're nice people, they're honest people. Right, where I lived in Indiana for a few years, people go to church, they believe in God, they care about ethics over there. And yet my tradition seems to tell me something else. So I think this problem is not a new one. I think it's a problem that was addressed squarely in the 19th century and for various historical reasons has been forgotten. We'll relate to this a little bit later in the talk. But the bottom line is that when we have such a problem, such an issue of our tradition saying one thing and our reality being the other, so we have to re-examine both. Right? I think Sadia Gaon says the same thing, as when you have a conflict between our understanding of Torah and our understanding of science, we have to re-examine both. He says that a contradiction between one real truth and another real truth cannot be. Therefore, one of them is not really correct. One of them is a misunderstanding of the truth. And I would suggest the same thing be the case here. That certainly we have to think twice, that perhaps the non-Jews that look like they're kind and upstanding people may not be. But on the other hand, we may also have to look back at our Jewish tradition and see that perhaps maybe we do not understand it as well as we think we do. Now, in the case of the Christian West, the central figure that Chazal, that the rabbis have associated with these people, is the figure of Esav. And Esav, at least in Jewish tradition, we know, is not a very wonderful person to be connected with. Right? What's his last name in our tradition? Right? Harasha, right, Esav Harasha. We have Avraham Avinu, right, Moshe Rabbeinu, Avraham, and Esav Harasha. Right, so we're not off to a good start over here. And in fact, in an honest presentation, I don't know if I've seen every single statement of the rabbis, right, of Chazal, the authors of the Talmud and the Midrash, but of the many that I've seen, I think I've certainly seen the vast majority of them, I can tell you that in fact most of them, 90% I would say, are in fact negative, and sometimes quite negative. Just to mention a few, to remind you, Rashi actually brings a more mellow version of what happened when Esav was Ayef. When he was Ayef, he was very hungry, right? He came and Yaakov was able to get the birthright from him. So according to Rashi, who remembers what he was Ayef from, right? Maybe remember, what was he doing? He was killing, right? That's what Rashi says. That's based in the Talmud, in Chazal. The more potent version in Bava Batra, Daf Tet Zayin, Amud Bet, is even stronger. It says he didn't just kill, he actually committed five sins that day, right? He took an engaged woman, right? The sin that we know about for sure, he's despised the birthright, that's also there. But he also committed two theological sins, right? He was Kofer Beikar, it says. He was Kofer B'Tchet HaMeitim, right? He was Kofer Beikar, he became a heretic, right? And he also denied the Tchiyat HaMeitim, reliving of the dead, reviving of the dead, right? Even when the moment where Esav shows his best face, he kisses Yaakov, even that's not good enough for Chazal, right? The root Nishika, Neshek, right? And Nun Shin Kuf, they change into a Chaf, right? Instead of kissing, he really wanted to bite. Right? So is one tradition goes. And so on and so forth. Right? In fact, even on the very statement where Rashi brings a more positive version in the name of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, it starts with a preamble that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says, no, he really felt kindness towards his brother, even though halacha biyadua, it's well known that Esav sone Yaakov, right? Even when you say something good, you still have to bring in something bad as well. So in fact, it's hard to deny that Jewish tradition has a generally negative view of Esav. And if in fact the connection between Esav and the Christian West is going to hold, then we certainly have a problem in justifying any sort of fraternal feelings that we might have for our Christian neighbors. Now, as I said before, this problem is not new to the late 20th century, the beginning of the 21st century. This is a problem that I think many Jewish leaders and thinkers were already encountering on a number of occasions, but most intensely in the 19th century. And some of the sources that I brought with me this evening are from various thinkers of the 19th century who did exactly what we suggested before and said there's something wrong here. And what we have to do is look back at the Jewish tradition and see if it really says what we think it says. That Esav is a Rasha, there's no hope for him, there's nothing to be done. And in fact, we should keep away as much as possible. And if they look like they're nice, don't buy it. So some of the thinkers are well known for having said this, and others less so. But what's interesting is the sources that I'm bringing to you are all not independent sources. Rabbis in the 19th century simply saying, let's forget what the Talmud says. Or perhaps a generous version, Talmud was speaking about something else. They felt it was very important to root our thought in the words and in the thoughts of the rabbinic sages of the Talmud and the Midrash, the rabbis that we call Chazal. And I think this is an important point, as opposed to my respected colleague, Professor Yehuda Gelman, who spoke to you a month ago, brought to you, not only did he bring to you the Buddha, but he also brought to you Rav Kook, Rav Avram Yitzchak Cohen Kook, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha, to prove his point, saying that I have an approach that's based in Rav Kook. Well, certainly it's better to base it in Rav Kook than not to base it in anyone. But Rav Kook represents a radical and novel approach to Judaism. And that's fine. I certainly have no problems with that. But that means that you're going away from the mainstream. And if you must do that, then again, I have no problem with that. But I think it behooves us to, first of all, look at the mainstream Jewish tradition before we go on to radical and novel approaches. I think the most successful and obvious thing to do is to look back at our tradition and say, what does our tradition say? Did the rabbis really think that these people were incurable anti-Semites? Right? Or perhaps not. And the Netziv was one of the people who took a look back at the tradition and saw something else. The first two sources that I have on the front side of the page are from the Netziv. The Netziv, to remind you, is Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the Rosh Shiva of the Volozhiner Yeshiva through much of the 19th century. Right? He was perhaps the leading scholar in his time. He wrote a number of things, but among them, he's perhaps most famous for his commentary on the Chumash, called the Hemek Davar. It's a wonderful commentary. I recommend it to everyone who is interested. In any case, Netziv says as follows, in the first source, V'yivku, when Yaakov and Esav meet after a long separation, they both cry. And says the Netziv about this encounter, this reunion, Balamed, in source one, Balamed shegam Yaakov nitorer alav l'sha'azo ahaval Esav. Says the Netziv that it comes to teach us they both cried, not just Esav, but also Yaakov, that he also felt love towards his brother. V'chen ledorot, says the Netziv, in fact, this is a lesson for Yaakov's descendants and Esav's descendants, specifically, b'sha'as shezera Esav mitorim beruach tara lakir et zera Yisrael umalatam, that in times when the children of Esav are aroused in a holy, rather in a pure spirit, to recognize the children of Israel and their level and their greatness, az gam anachnu mitorim lakir et Esav. We also turn around and recognize Esav. To recognize means to recognize his greatness. Why should we do that? Says the Netziv, ki achenu. Because Esav is our brother. Not in the sense that simply it's a protexia, but that there's greatness there. And when they're able to come and recognize us, it is appropriate, says the Netziv, that we should recognize them as well and see what they have to offer. He says, however, this is not simply his nice, liberal, 19th century Enlightenment idea, but rather he says this is from the Talmud. How does he know that? B'kamo, sh'rebi aya ohev amiti l'antoninus v'chen harbe. Says the Netziv, I have a source in the Talmud. If you look in the tractate Avodah Zarah, you'll see there was a very warm and tight relationship between Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the prince, and the emperor, the governor, right, of the province known as Antoninus, right? Some say it's Marcus Aurelius. Whoever it is, right, Rabbi had a very close relationship where he even taught Torah to this Roman general leader, whoever he was, who was certainly not a Jew, who certainly was viewed as a descendant of Esav, as we'll see later on. Later than Tziv, actually earlier in the Torah, he says, when they're first born, right, in Perchav Chafei, right, then Tziv speaks about when Yaakov is holding on to the heel of Esav, and he points out that even when it comes to exile and being subjugated, the Gemara in Gittin, right, says that we'd rather, it's better for us to be subjugated to the sons of Esav than to anyone else. Right? The Gemara doesn't speak about that so much, but simply says, better him than others. Right? The next source, or two sources, are from someone who's more famous or more well-known as an Enlightenment thinker. Someone who is very close to the ideas of modernity, to the ideas of democracy, and many of the other concepts that were emerging in the 19th century, and that the Jews should welcome these developments, which was viewed as very radical in its time. And this, of course, I'm speaking of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch of Germany. And in the first section that's quoted, the famous idea of Rav Hirsch, where he quotes from Mishle Hanoch Na'ar al Pi Darko, that one is supposed to teach children according to their different propensities. The way, you know, not every child is created differently. Some are active, some are thinkers, some like to meditate, some like to play, and one has to gear the education according to who the child is. He says, you know what? That Esav's behavior, you know, the fact that he became, as he himself says, a wild hunter, is not really Esav's fault. Whose fault it is? His parents. That's what he says, right? His father, Rivka and Yitzchak, did not educate Esav properly, did not recognize his potential, and they raised him the same way as they raised Yaakov, and they made a mistake, and that's why Esav came out the way he did. Now again, Rav Hirsch also does not simply say, I have a great idea over here, right? Again, I see the non-Jews seem very civil, they seem basically decent, many of them, and therefore I'm going to look into the Torah and read it the way I see my environment. But rather, Rav Hirsch says, no, if you look at the beginning, he quotes, he says, our sages, and then he a parenthetical comment, here too, if you go in the fourth line, right, our sages here too on Vigdalu make a remark, which is indeed a signpost for all of us. Now, he doesn't really quote the source. Rashi, however, does, and I'll, again, fairly famous source, but I'll just tell it to you. In Perek Chafei, on Pasuk Chavav, Chavzayin, the Pasuk says, Vigdalu ha-na'arim, that the two boys grew old, V'yeh-Esav ish yodet Said, ish sadev, Yaakov ish tam yoshev to ohalim. So Rashi brings down the Midrash from Breishit Rabbah over here, and he says as follows, Kol zman shayu ktanim lo ayu nikarim b'maaseihem, v'in adam medagdeg behem, mativam. Kevan shnasu bnei yud gimol ze pirash lebatim mitchashol ze pirash lavodat ilulim. Right, the Midrash says that so long as they were little, no one knew who they were. No one knew what they were about. Once they became 13, they split off in completely different and diametrically opposed ways. Rav Hirsch reads this statement of Chazal, of the rabbis, as saying, what do you mean you didn't know who they were till they were 13? That in fact, the Midrash is attacking the parents of Esav on some level and saying they should have known. What do you mean you didn't know who he was till he was 13? Right? So again, whether you agree with Rav Hirsch's reading of the Midrash or not, Rav Hirsch is saying, this is not me, but rather Chazal. The same one who called Esav Arasha turn around and say, but you know what? It wasn't his fault. Right? He could have been, and Rav Hirsch develops this very at great length in various essays, that he could have been a great Jew, says Rav Hirsch, again basing himself on Chazal. The second one we won't go through except to say that here too, Rav Hirsch, and this time not so much based on Chazal, but an extension of his own, seeing in his own environment that there is a, I don't know if we say remez, that there is in the text a reason for us to see that there will be a time where Esav will more and more show greater decency and appreciation of ethics, and therefore for what Jews are trying to bring to the world. Now, the next source is really the clincher. If you turn over the page, it's a fascinating midrash that Rashi brings in stylized fashion, but very curious and very strange. Right? This midrash, again, Rashi brings it, speaking about why Yaakov only brought 11 children in front of Esav. If you remember, at that point, he had how many children? He had 12, right? Right? One was missing. Right? So you have to figure out who was missing. So the rabbis immediately assume that it was Dina, that it was his daughter who was missing. So the Midrash over there, right, the source is in Midrash Rabbah, right, ask in the middle of the source, the middle of the line, V'dina heichan hi. Where was Dina? Right? If she wasn't with him, where'd he put her? So we all know the answer, right? What's the answer? Where you put her? Into a box, right? Nina b'teva, v'na'al b'faneya. Right? He closed the box, he shut the box, and he put her in the box and closed in front of her, or locked in front of her. Amar ha'shazeh eno rama, eno ramahi. Yaakov said, this evil Esav has a eye that looks up, right? He's going to look at my daughter. Shlo yitleina v'ireota. Rather, he shouldn't see my daughter. V'kach ota mimeni, and take her from me. Take her, right, as a wife. So this was the plan of Yaakov. And for this plan, he's castigated. He's told by the Midrash, by the rabbis, that he did something wrong. Right, it continues. Rav Huna b'shem Rabbi Abba Kohen bar de la amar, amar lo kadosh baruch hu lemas mera'ehu hased menata me'echa hesed menata hasdecha min achuch de'ilu it nasevat legavra lo zinta. And it goes on. The midrash says, right, you didn't want to let Esav. You prevented kindness from your brother. You didn't want to let Esav marry Dina. So what? And because of that, she went out to znut. She went out to promiscuity. The punishment, I mean, it's a whole discussion, but the punishment in this particular sense is directed at Yaakov for not allowing Esav, right? What's Esav's last name? Harasha, right? Esav Harasha, to marry Dina, who presumably we could say Hatzadeket, right? I mean, he's the daughter of Yaakov, Avinu, right? And Rashi adds to this, trying to understand the logic, that why would we want to set up such a pair? How could we even countenance such a pair? It must be, Rashi says, Shema, maybe she would bring him to become righteous. Okay, so first of all, Rashi understands that there's a possibility that Esav could become righteous. He understands this from the Midrash, from Chazal. But what's interesting is the Torah Tamima's interpretation. Torah Tamima is Baruch HaLevi Epstein, right? Who is the son of the Aruch HaShulchan and a nephew of the Netziv that we just quoted earlier. But in any case, he also has an interesting reading here. And he says, you know, it still doesn't make sense. What do you mean? Maybe she'll make him into a Baal Tshuva. So, according to that, all the rabbis, the Gdol HaDor, right? We're supposed to go out and go to South Tel Aviv or go to the Bronx, and you go look for a shidduch for your daughter over there. You look in the gangs, right? You look in the motorcycle gangs. You look at the drug dealers, right? There's where you should look for shidduchim. Why are you looking at other children of Rosh Yeshiva? This is where you look, right? So what's going on here? How can you castigate? How can you accuse of Yaakov of acting inappropriately? So look at what he says over here, right? He says, "Umach tavrashi shenase Yaakov al shemanash." Excuse me, shenenash. That Rashi writes that Yaakov was punished about keeping away Dina. Shemanah Dina meEsav shema tachzirel mutav. Sarech Bior, the statement, as we said, needs explanation. He asked the same question. Hecha matzinu ki haigavne, where do we see such a thing? Shiyechoval adam limsoret bitol rasha. A person has an obligation to marry his daughter to a rasha. Shema yichzirenu Lemutav, so that maybe he'll become a Baal Tshuva. Right? Why create Baal Tshuva yeshivas? Just marry your daughters off to people. Right? V'halo keneged zeh yesh chasha shema yachzirane hu l'risha. Can't you say that it could also work out the other way, that she would become a Rasha as a result? Or default. Right? No one changes each other. Right? One of my students pointed out that maybe they would switch roles and she would become a Rasha and he would become a Tzaddik. I guess that's the fourth logical possibility. But barring that, it's not a good scenario. You don't do things like that, says the Torah Tmima. So he gives a wild answer because of this logical problem. He says as follows. So it's therefore possible to say that Yaakov had no doubt about this. He knew that Dina would bring him. He knew his daughter, he knew his brother, and he knew that the shiduch would work in such a way that she would cause him to do tshuva. So what's going on? So, ach mipnei ze gufa lo ratza la'asiya oto lo. And that's why, says the Torah Tmima, he didn't want Dina to marry Esav. Not Shema, not lest he bring her, she bring him to do tshuva, but because he would come and do tshuva as a result. Says the Torah Tmima, continues, Kadesh lo taksir el mutav. He didn't want him to become a Baal Tshuva righteous person. Klomar, says the Torah Tmima, that since Yaakov hated Esav, he didn't want Esav to become a Baal Tshuva. He knew that Esav had this potential. He knew he had a way to get him to do tshuva and become a righteous person. But because he hated his brother, he refused to do this, and therefore he was punished. Right? This is a total reversal of what we said earlier, the famous Chazal, of Halacha Yedua, right? It's a famous Halacha that Esav hates Yaakov. Here the Torah Tmima says, but you know what? There's another Midrash that seems to indicate, at least according to the Torah Tmima, that it's Yaakov Shesonet Esav, right? And there's a reflection of this, by the way, in the letters of Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who also asked the same question. I mean, his view of the non-Jews is considered questionable by many because in the early period of the Nazi regime, he was not necessarily against them. But be that as it may, Rav Weinberg asked in one of his letters, is it really the non-Jews that hate the Jews, or is it perhaps really the opposite, that if we take an honest look at ourselves, that perhaps it's Yaakov Shesone et Esav. Okay, so I've brought for you various sources of 19th century Parshanim, 19th century Gdolim, who discovered and interpreted sources in Chazal that present a different light on Esav, which was more in tune with what they saw around them. And therefore saw that perhaps Chazal are not coming down so strongly against Esav after all. Now the question is, we found some new sources, but we didn't get rid of the other sources. So what do we do? Right? That's why the title, Will the Real Esav Please Stand Up? Right? Who is he? Is he this person who is worthy of marrying? Right? Dina bat Yaakov Avinu. Right? A person who is capable of having a relationship of a Rebbe and Antoninus, right? A person who has moral standing, right? Or is he the bloodthirsty murderer who's doing five sins a day, right? Who is he? What did Chazal really think? So is it merely a question of, since 90% are negative and 10% are positive, that we go by majority rule? So I think there are two approaches, one of which I'll present for the sake of intellectual honesty, and the second one which I favor, which I think also is deserving of presentation. The first one is a Gemara in Shabbat. Many of you probably have heard of it before. It's on Daf Lamed Gimel, Amud Bet, I believe. where there's a discussion between three of the sages. Famous discussion, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And they're speaking about the Romans. Of course, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai got into trouble because the Romans found out about what he said. Right? So that's how the story begins. But Rabbi Yehuda says, these people are great. They're wonderful. They're building bridges, they're really building shopping centers, right? And Merchatzot, they're bringing progress to our nation, to our land, right? Similar to the British. I mean, the electrical system, the roads, the railroads. No one forced them to do it. They spent their money. Why should they spend their money? It says Rabbi Yehuda, they're doing something good. It's an unusual nation. Rabbi Yossi didn't say anything. Usually the wisest approach. And Rav Shimon Bar Yochai said, what are you talking about? These people, everything they do for themselves. Right? The bridges are to collect taxes. The marketplaces are to put prostitutes in front of. Everything they're just doing for themselves. They don't care about us. They don't care about ethics. They don't care about progress. They simply are finding clever and devious ways to advance their own selfish interests. So it could be, just like there's a machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, that the different sources that we've seen about Esav are also different approaches within Chazal. After all, Chazal was not just one person. Chazal was many people with different opinions sometimes about different topics. And one could say simply that in fact there was a machloket about the nature of Esav among the rabbis of that period. That's certainly one approach. I would say, based on some other sources, that I think there is perhaps a deeper approach that is more harmonious, meaning that most of the sources really fit into a picture about Esav that the rabbis, by and large, all subscribe to. And I'm going to speak to you about three sources, only one of which I have here. The first one, again, is something that Rashi brings down from Sefer Midrash Agadah at the very beginning when Yaakov and Esav are wrestling around in their mother's womb. So Rashi brings two possibilities of what this wrestling is. Right, so one is famous. I mean, they're both famous, but one is more famous than the other, the one I'm not going to talk about. That Yaakov was running out to pray, and every time they passed the Beit Midrash, he would try to run out. And every time they would pass by Avodah Zarah, Esav tried to run out. Right? Anybody remember the other thing that Rashi says over there? What's the other possibility? What were they running around? What were they doing? It's less famous. Right? So he says, Dvar Acher, this is another possibility. Shehu merivim benachalat shnei olamot. They were wrestling, they were fighting, Merivim, right, about the inheritance of the two worlds. Right? What are the two worlds? Olam Hazeh, Olam Haba, right? The physical world and the spiritual world. Now, if you look carefully at what that Midrash is saying, they were fighting about both. Right? As opposed to the previous statement, it's not that one person is running one way and says, I'll see you later, and the other person is running the other way and says, I'll see you later. But here, they want everything. Right? They both want everything. Why am I bringing this up? Right? It's interesting about Yaakov, but it's not the subject of our discussion. But rather, what's interesting is that we see that Esav appears interested from the womb in not only the physical world, which we're well aware of, but also the spiritual world from the womb, at least according to this Midrash. There's another similar Midrash, which I do have listed, though I badly butchered it because I had to type it in myself. So I didn't want to write too many Hebrew letters. But in any case, this is from Shir Hashirim Zuta. It's a fascinating thing. Right? The Midrash starts, I'm starting outside of the quote, Adam HaGadol, right? Who is Adam HaGadol? Who is the great man? So the Midrash says, Elu Avraham Yitzchak V'Yaakov. Who's the great man? Avraham Yitzchak V'Yaakov. Fine, this we know. Right? B'Yaakov k'tiv v'igdalu. By Yaakov, what's the proof that he was gadol? Because there's an intimation of this. It says, as we quoted before, v'igdalu. They grew up. The only problem is, if you're going to say that about Yaakov, it doesn't say v'igdal, it says v'igdalu. Right? So who's the other person who also was gadol alongside Yaakov? It was Esav. Right? And the Midrash says that, quite frankly. It says, of course. And then it continues, v'esav haya bechlal. And it's true that in fact Esav was also considered among this Adam HaGadol. Right? El shekilkel b'masav. Right? But he was polluted by his actions. Okay? The Midrash is saying something very interesting, that there really should have been four avot, right? Interesting, just like there are four imahot, right? And this again has deeper connections in terms of the two imahot, right? Leah and Rivka is missing one husband, right? But be that as it may, again for another time, here you have someone missing, right? There should be four gedolim: Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Vesav haya bechlal. Esav should have been the fourth. But he polluted himself with his actions. Similar idea expressed in Masechet Avodah Zarah. We spoke before about this relationship between Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and Antoninus, right, the Roman. As I mentioned, Rabbi taught him Torah. He became very knowledgeable. And he asked at one point, Antoninus, this is Masechet Avodah Zarah, Daf Yud, Amud Bet. He asks, Antoninus asks Rabbi, Atina la'alma da'ati, can you bring me to the world to come? Again, an interest in the both alamot. Can you bring me, Rabbi, to the world to come? So he says, "In, yes, I can, I will." So, but Antoninus had learned Tanakh, right? Not just Gemara, he'd also learned Tanakh. So he said, "How can you say such a thing?" Right? Because in Sefer Ovadia, right? How many of us know Sefer Ovadia? But Antoninus knows Sefer Ovadia. It says, "V'haktiv lo yisrid lebeit Esav." But it says in Sefer Ovadia that there won't be a remnant in the house of Esav. So how can I make it over there? It's a world that's eternal. So Rebbe answers him, "Be'oseh ma'aseh Esav," that the book of Ovadia is speaking only about someone who does the same actions as Esav. Because kikel b'masav, his actions were improper. But his spirit, but his soul, is one of greatness. And the Gemara goes on, but this is the basic thrust of the Gemara. So what I suggest in rereading the sources, the traditional sources, is that Chazal were much wiser than people for many centuries have given them credit. And while on the one hand they saw barbarian people around them in the guise of the Roman Empire, there's a story, a rabbi friend of mine, he was visiting with his congregants in the old city of Yerushalayim. And there's a place I'm told that still exists called the Culinarium in the old city. I don't know how many of you have been there. It doesn't exist. That's what I thought also, but someone told me it does. Loyadeh, whatever. Used to exist, that we all agree upon. That is no machloket. It once existed. Anyways, yeah, you get dressed up as Romans. You get dressed up as Romans and you eat Roman food. That's the idea. It's a gimmick in different places in the world, but that's what it is in the old city. So his congregants were Hevramanim. They say, okay, Rabbi, here we have a toga for you also. Right? Every rabbi's dream, what you expect your congregants to ask you. Here, Rabbi, put on a toga. Right? So the rabbi, in this case, a very serious intellectual man of great standing, and he said to them, I don't think you understand what this is. He says, it's like you're taking me to a German restaurant and asking me to put on a Nazi outfit. He says, you don't realize the type of persecutions that the Romans gave over to the Jews. So the rabbis, on the one hand, they saw what was around them, and they saw people that did not show refinement, people that, I mean, circuses and the Colosseums and the sort of immorality that would go on, if you read about this, it's mind-boggling. They saw this with open eyes, and they recognized the actions of Esau. But at the same token, they were refined themselves enough to look into the Torah and look beneath the actions of the people around them and say that there is greatness there. And this, I think, is a way of reading all the sources that we've seen, both positive and negative, in a more harmonious fashion. That in fact, there is a great spiritual soul to the nations that are represented by Esav. And there is a thirst for spirituality that comes out from time to time. But quite often in history, it's covered over by their Yetzer Hara, by their actions on the ground. But certainly, if that's true, if this is in fact the vision of Chazal, when we do see, as the Netziv says, when we do see that they recognize the Jews and show an interest in the morality that we're trying to bring to the world, then our reaction should not, I think, be one of disbelief and suspicion, but rather, I think, in Jewish tradition, we should respond in kind and show that we are interested not just in what we have to gain, but more importantly, that they give us an opportunity to fulfill our task as Mamlechet Kohanim. So I want to just summarize, based on what we said, the implications of a 19th century rereading of Chazal. Again, I mentioned earlier that this is nothing new that I'm teaching you. It's something that I think was popular in the 19th century. But the Holocaust and the atrocities before and after made us forget this approach. But as much as we should recognize and respect the memory of the Holocaust, we have to live in our times. And times are different. And things are not the same as they were 60 years ago. And even during the great inferno that was the Holocaust, I dare say, there still was great humanity in many places, in many parts of the Christian world, and especially among those that recognize their own religious tradition. But be that as it may, today, I think it behooves us to look at our role as Mamlechet Kohanim with dead seriousness, and to understand that if non-Jews are flocking to pseudo-Judaism, it's because there's a real thirst out there. And again, this is a complicated issue. I'm not coming to resolve all the issues, but simply to point out that we see, very possibly, in classical Jewish tradition, a nuanced approach that says that in fact there is great potential out there, and that when the potential reveals itself, we in fact have to respond. Thank you.
Take some questions. I'll just start by saying maybe we can suggest that as a model, the evangelical Christians represent the strain of Christianity that is obviously respectful of Israel or supportive of Israel, and seemingly respectful of the Torah and maybe it's somewhere to start in the Christian world.
Yeah, we had this summer a speaker whose name escapes me right now, but very involved in ecumenical interaction with various groups, both Christian, Muslim, perhaps others. Thank you. Sorry, David Rosen. The American Jewish Committee. In any case, he has a lot more experience than I in the field, and he says that this particular juncture, on the ecumenical level, the closest ties that we have are actually with the Catholic Church. There's tremendous interaction in the last few years since the Pope's visit to Israel. My own aside is my mother used to work in a Catholic school for many, many years, and there were very cordial relations there. As far as the evangelical Christians, again, my experience is limited, but not completely limited. And again, many of the people that I went to college with were, in fact, evangelical Christians. What I can tell you about that my personal view, and again, perhaps you have more expertise, is that there's a wide spectrum of evangelical Christians. And on one extreme, I think there are those that are not that interested in anything that is to our ultimate advantage, even though in the short term, you know, as Menachem Begin once said, you know, the long term I don't care about as long as they help me now. That's one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, the more moderate evangelicals, I think, are very serious in their warmth and respect. And I think that's something that we do need to see from them, that there's a real respect, that Judaism is an acceptable option for Jews, which is very tricky in Christian theology. It's not an easy step to make for any Christians. Yeah?
You touched about a number of times on the fact that, particularly in the 19th century, Chazal had views that were perhaps more moderate with regard to Esau, and also Rebbe also. But you touched upon it, but you perhaps didn't mention, this is really historicity. In other words, how history has determined the view of Chazal with relation to an important issue. And Rabbi Yehuda Nasi at the same time, but he lived, Jewish-Roman relations were much better than they were under Jesus before.
Correct.
And this is pleasantly radical, of course, but nevertheless, it's worth noting that the historical time determined to a certain extent the Chazal's view on how they viewed the restrictions in this sense and perhaps in many other issues as well.
Right, certainly. I mean, I think that one can't help but be influenced by one's environment, and that one is even, I mean, you'll see in my book, if you care to buy it, that one is expected to read one's own consciousness, which is necessarily determined by one's environment, back into the text. In other words, the Ramban's reading of the text is very different than the Netziv. And much of the reason for that is because they have different sensitivities that are created by their time. And I believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, creating both Torah and man, understood that that would be not only natural, but legitimate. It's a legitimate way, and the only way of really reading the text. The text develops on that level.
It's not widely accepted in Orthodox circles. That,
Or the Cordozo Academy. by the way, it depends what you mean by which circles. There's a spectrum there also. There are those like us who accept it and say it. There are those who accept it and don't say it. And then there's those who don't accept it at all. And my sense is probably there's a very large group in the middle. Why people don't say things they believe, I'm still trying to come to terms with. Yeah.
On a practical level, what are you saying we should do about it?
Yeah, see, I believe that practical action is formed by one's hashkafic and philosophical approach to things. I think that many movements within modern Orthodoxy are and have been failing because they try to, from my point of view, put the horse before the cart before the horse, and say, let's do something. For example, move to try to bring more religious opportunities to women, I think that there's been too much of a rush to try to create all sorts of new rituals and find halachic ways to bring about such opportunities. I think that's a mistake so long as we don't have a different view of women in Judaism. I think what's critical is that we study our text with an appreciation of the legitimacy of a modern perspective, which is what's true in this case. So at this point, I'm interested in the study, but because I believe that the study is what leads to the ma'aseh. I'm not starting any mass movements to get in touch and create all sorts of interaction with non-Jews, but I think that's a natural outgrowth. In other words, when you have a certain hashkafa, things flow out of it naturally. So rather than suggest, after hearing one lecture, to do anything, I would rather suggest that we focus our learning on bringing this approach back into it. Yeah?
Can I ask, going back to the detail about Yaakov?
Sure.
You said he didn't want to give Esau the opportunity to
like, that sounds wacky, right? Yeah.
Was he jealous? Was he afraid? What was the reason? Like, what was he? Why was he angry? Why did he hate Esau?
Yeah.
Esau had reason to hate him.
Yeah. Why did he hate Esau? I think again, this is a long story. The Netziv also reflects such an idea. He says, this goes back to Purim, he says also in Breishit on his commentary, that the cry that Mordechai and the Jews gave out in Shushan was poetic justice for the cry that Esav had sent out. And the Netziv says the cry wasn't the problem. The problem was that Yaakov enjoyed hearing him cry. Again, how he gets this is not so important. We don't have enough time to really discuss it. But if you ask me how I understand the source, a very difficult source, obviously, I would say that Yaakov saw in his brother something which he felt was not on the level for communion with God. In other words, his paradigm was that of Yitzhak, the holy man who's isolated, who's completely involved with God. Again, if you look through the sources, one sees that. Yaakov, in his early life, before he became Israel, and in my book I suggest that when he becomes Israel, there's more room for the brothers to work together. But in any case, my personal reading is that Yaakov felt that anybody who felt short of the standards of Yitzhak was simply not worthwhile. Again, you have a similar idea in a type, a character type that's very similar to Yitzhak in the early Yaakov, the Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. And if you remember, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, who isolates himself from the entire world, right, because the world is involved in work. The world is wasting time. You know, you could be praying, you could be learning, and what are you doing? You're planting a tree, right? And when he goes out of his cave, what does he do? He starts killing people with his eyes, right? So I would suggest that the approach of a Yaakov is on that level. And again, there's not enough time for this evening. I touch upon it in my book. But the approach is one of religious excellence, the flip side of which is a certain religious intolerance. Okay, but that's, again, it's a long topic. Yeah.
I seem to notice that there are two Greek redeeming features in Esau, which, for example, Ishmael didn't have. Nobody goes to the trouble of putting Ishmael into a positive light. But Esau, first of all, he was born not only of Yitzhak, but also of Rivka, which is not what happened to Ishmael, it was from Hagar. Right. So he had that DNA in him, and Yichus in him from his mother. And the second thing was that Yaakov really feared him for one reason. The kavod that he was able to give to his father while he wasn't there at home brought him to understand that there was a very important factor in the life of Esau, which was the redeeming feature.
That's true. As a note, there are positive statements about Yishmael in Chazal, but they're of a different type. But the point is well taken, which I think what the Netziv is referring to, Achinuhu, the fact that he is closer in the family, I think is of great significance. Certainly your second point also is important. Okay, that it?
Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
And many thanks to the doctor of the Academy. And we will see you back moving next week. Let's take a moment today. Very good. I have a similar share called the Enigma of Asa. I'll just show you one thing you can add to this, which is a fantastic adjunct to this whole idea of that, you know, part of the suggestion of course is that Yaakov wanted to justify his birthright, and if Asa turns out better, like Yaakov of course. But there is a statement here. Originally, there should have been four votes for Yimahot, and Leah should have been blessed up to Esau. No, it didn't happen. But the DNA of Leah comes down to Dina. Therefore, therefore Rashi makes an amazing statement. Let's see it. Okay, in the story of Dina, so where it says, so Rashi says, why does it tell us Dina bat Leah? So Rashi's bothered by this. He says, below bat Yaakov, Ella, al shem yitzhiyata. Nikreit bat Leah, Shavi Yatsanit Haita. She too is the Yatsanit, Shinemar Batekileh Likrato, quoting that Pasuk. And here we say, Valem Mishalo Hamashal Ki Ima Kabita. What does Rashi mean by Yatsanit? I suggest it's not the gorgeous, but it means one who can bring the best out of somebody else. From the word lahotzi. That Leah could have done it. Thank you, Millie. Leah could have done it. She had the DNA, and that's what it meant. For other reasons, it was meant for all the Shvatim to come out of Yaakov. However, although Leah couldn't do it, her daughter had the same DNA, and Dina could have done it. She could have brought out of Asa the best. Therefore, she's called the Yatsanit, but not in a pejorative sense. But Yaakov.